headlines. The U.S. president says the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan marks the end of an era of major military operations to remake countries. The U.N. Secretary General warns of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan, saying half of all Afghans depend on some form of aid. Also, a new report shows the U.S. consumer confidence is at six-month low amid rising coronavirus infections and higher inflation. Well, welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. And with our top story, the U.S. president says the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan marked the end of an era of major military operations to remake countries.
This decision about Afghanistan is not just about Afghanistan. It's about ending an era of major military operations to remake other countries. The world is changing. We're engaged in a serious competition with China. We're dealing with the challenges on multiple fronts with Russia. We're confronted with cyber attacks and nuclear proliferation. We have to shore up America's competitiveness to meet these new challenges in the competition for the 21st century.
In his first public remarks since the U.S. pullout from the country, Joe Biden said the war in Afghanistan should have ended long ago. Biden rejected criticism of his decision to stick with the August 31st withdrawal deadline, adding that his choice was between leaving and escalating. The U.S. president emphasized that the evacuation operation from Afghanistan was, quote, an extraordinary success. He, however, acknowledged that up to 200 Americans were unable to get out when the airlift ended on Monday. Investigative journalist Tony Gusseling believes the United States invaded Afghanistan under false pretexts and continues to distort facts.
I'm afraid all this stuff about going over there to bomb terrorist training camps, military targets, that was what they were doing for the last 20 years, is obviously complete nonsense to anybody that's in touch with what's been going on the ground in Afghanistan. Really, I don't think a very real speech. This is just designed to pull the wool over the eyes of the US public, and I would hope that at least there'll be some questions asked by the journalists about just how real he thinks that threat to the United States ever was or is into the future from Afghanistan, which is really rather happy that these United States troops and the British troops and other NATO troops have gone. But the idea that they're going to be conducting terrorist attacks, if terrorist attacks did happen now, I would suggest that they're mostly being done by the West, by the NATO intelligence services, in order to try and politically exploit this to gain more power. This is what they do with the politicians. They say, oh, gosh, there's this terrible, terrible threat. We need more power. We need more money. And that's how the deep state operates in the West here.
Political commentator Jason Unruha believes the toppled government of Kabul lacked popular support because Afghans knew it was a puppet of the United States. Listen.
There was a relatively stable government before the United States decided to invade the country on the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda and trying to find those who were responsible for the events of September 11th, 2001. The fact is the United States put in a puppet government. There is no doubt that it was a government completely controlled by the United States to fulfill the interests of foreign companies, particularly those who are American. Now, the thing is, the United States is the one that put the government together, a government that the Afghan people more or less didn't actually support. I'm sure many Afghan people did want to live in peace and for there not to be a war, but they also very well knew that this president was essentially one that was created by the United States and knew they weren't going to serve their interests. So as much as they wanted peace, they weren't really all that emotionally invested in this president who very clearly would not do anything about the massacres the United States were carrying out in the country. So the United States from the beginning never had any great intentions for the Afghan people, and the Afghan people very well knew that.
Iran says the 20-year U.S. occupation of Afghanistan brought nothing but deaths and destruction to that country. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman made the comment after Washington formally announced the end of its military presence in Afghanistan. Saeed Khatib Zadeh described the U.S. withdrawal a historic opportunity for the war-torn nation. He urged Afghan leaders to seize this opportunity to alleviate people's plight by curbing violence and forming an inclusive government. Khatib Zadeh stressed that Iran stands with the Afghan nation. The U.S. invasion of Afghanistan comes to an end, and following the departure of the last plane carrying American troops. The Kabul International Airport is now under the control of the Taliban. Reports from the Afghan capital.
Patrolling inside Kabul International Airport, armed Taliban, who are the members of the group's elite forces known as Badri 313 Special Unit, are celebrating what they and their leaders name liberation of Afghanistan from U.S. invasion after departure of the last American military man from Kabul International Airport on August 31st.
Our nation stood alongside us in fighting U.S. invaders over the past 20 years. Finally, they gained our country's independence by forcing Americans to leave our country.
Press TV team went to insider parts of Kabul International Airport to find out what is going on. Some local and international journalists are seen on the runway doing interviews with Taliban officials. A number of aircrafts belonging to the country's national airline, Aryana Afghan Airlines, are also here, and the Taliban say they will resume their flights soon. And now we are inside the military section of the Kabul International Airport. As you see behind me, U.S. forces have left behind almost everything, including vehicles, aircraft, helicopters, and ammunition. But most of them are damaged, and the Taliban cannot use them, at least for now. Let's take a closer look to what the U.S. forces have done with what they have left behind themselves here in Kabul International Airport. It seems that American forces have been in a hurry to leave Afghanistan because they have left even their ready meal packages inside this helicopter. And of course, they have damaged it as much as they could. Maulawi Muhammad Nabi, a Taliban commander, and his comrades are happy. He says the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan is considered as the end of country's destruction and the so-called U.S. war on terror. He also blames the U.S. for not being honest with Afghans.
We are very happy as God granted us liberty from U.S. invasion. The U.S. forces were not honest with us. For instance, they have even destroyed some helicopters that were granted to the former Afghan government by the Indian government.
The last U.S. military forces left Kabul International Airport after almost 2 weeks of supervising the evacuation process of over 100,000 foreign and Afghan nationals. The process was too chaotic as tens of thousands of Afghans had rushed around the airport to get in to take a flight and flee the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The UN Secretary General warns of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan. Addressing an emergency session of the Security Council, Antonio Guterres said half of all Afghans depend on some form of humanitarian aid. He added that hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced in the recent fighting and asked the international community to harbor Afghan refugees. He urged all parties to protect civilians and, quote, exercise utmost restraint. Guterres also expressed concern over accounts of mounting human rights violations against women and girls. Elsewhere in his remarks, the UN chief called for unity to prevent the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan. The UK was one of the first countries that joined the 2001 U.S. military invasion of Afghanistan. Over 20 years, it threw billions of pounds in taxpayer money into the illegal war and saw hundreds of its troops coming home in flag-draped coffins. While the British government tries to sell the gains from the war, anti-war activists are calling it a defeat. 20 years in the making.
I'm here to announce the completion of our withdrawal from Afghanistan and the end of the military mission to evacuate American citizens, third country nationals, and vulnerable Afghans.
An end to a devastating war that took tens of thousands of lives, destroyed livelihoods, and left behind a country reeling.
It was never thought through. It was an intervention on one side in the civil war and the promotion of one side in the civil war. It got rid of the Taliban very quickly, but we know 20 years on, we know we're back where we started.
Back in charge, the Taliban rejoiced with gunfire as the last of U.S. troops took to the skies. European ally UK completed its withdrawal 2 days earlier. Or did it?
I know that the number of UK nationals, the particular responsibility of the Foreign Office, is now down at a very low level.
To be specific.
Well, low hundreds.
The UK lost more than 450 troops in Afghanistan and spent nearly £20 billion in British taxpayer money on it. The stated goal of the US-led war was to root out terrorism in the wake of 9/11. 20 years on, and by Washington's own admission, there are some 2,000 Daesh terrorists operating in Afghanistan.
And we saw the suicide bombing the other day and the rocket attacks. Where did this come from? It came from the war and the occupation. This is the soil which allows terrorism to grow. We've seen it in Iraq, we've seen it in Libya, and we're seeing it in Afghanistan as well. So I think it's very dishonest of the British government to suggest that that in some ways they've made terrorism less of a threat.
As UK government officials tell the British public about the gains of the devastating war in Afghanistan and airlift cats and dogs instead of humans out of the country, calls for an inquiry into the outcome of the war are getting louder.
For those who oppose the war before it even happened, what we saw in Afghanistan over the past couple of weeks was a defeat for Western governments, including the UK's military intervention policy, dressed up as humanitarianism. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Well, the Syrian army has reportedly stepped up its efforts to protect the last stronghold of Western-backed militants in the country's southern province of Dara. Military sources said dozens of missiles have been fired into Dar al-Balad. Fighting escalated earlier this week after a Russian proposed peace plan aimed at preventing an all-out confrontation collapsed. On Monday, four Syrian soldiers were killed and 15 others wounded after terrorists targeted security checkpoints in Dar'a. Syrian government forces have opened a corridor for civilians to leave the area amid the fighting. Onto our other headline story, a survey shows a drop in U.S. consumer confidence to a six-month low amid concerns about soaring coronavirus infections and higher inflation. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index dropped to a reading of 113.8 in August, the lowest since February. The report shows more consumers plan to go on vacation, indicating a shift in spending from goods to services. It also indicates that consumers will be less inclined to buy a home, motor vehicles, and major household appliances over the next 6 months. Meanwhile, the University of Michigan survey of consumers showed a drop to near decade lows in August due to rising prices and resurgence in COVID-19 cases. Some 1.3 million American households, mostly in the state of Louisiana, are left without power in the aftermath of Hurricane Ida. A local official said some 440,000 residents may have to manage without power for at least a month before utility poles toppled during the storm are reinstalled. The blackout and widespread flooding have affected even essential businesses, raising concerns. Ida made landfall in Louisiana on Sunday as a Category 4 hurricane, but weakened as it swept up north. The storm has so far killed two people. The death toll, however, is expected to rise as search and rescue operations are still ongoing. Venezuela's main opposition parties, in reversal of previous strategy, say they will participate in November's regional and local elections. Opposition parties now want a change in boycotting votes to ease Venezuela's economic woes. A leader in the party of opposition leader Juan Guaido even called for, quote, coexistence with President Nicolas Maduro, rather than trying to force a change in government. Maduro welcomed the announcement. Opposition parties boycotted previous elections in the past 2 years based on claims that voting under the current administration was neither free nor fair. That assertion led to a U.S.-led campaign of sanctions and pressure. Washington went as far as to recognize Guaido as the country's president. French President Emmanuel Macron has once again caused deep offense after attacking Islam on social media. Following a weekend tour of Iraq, Macron conflated Islam with the Daesh while simultaneously stealing full credit for the group's defeat. Robert Carter explains.
French President Emmanuel Macron has again caused serious offense to Muslims over the weekend by issuing controversial remarks conflating Islam to extremism and the terrorist actions of notorious Takfiri group Daesh. The comments published during a state visit to Iraq claimed that even though France defeated Daesh, the battle against Islamic terrorism isn't over.
He just can't seem to help himself, even during a trip which was meant to smooth over damaged relations between France and the Muslim world. Macron again attacked the very religion which its adherents both played the biggest role in defeating the terrorist organization, but also suffered the most at its hands.
This isn't the first time Macron has smeared Islam as a terrorist religion. In October last year, Macron condemned Islam as a religion in crisis, while introducing new laws which criminalizes some Islamic beliefs, and even defended insults against Islam's holy prophet. All in response to minority lone wolf terrorist attacks by Takfiris, which the Muslim world condemns.
The claim by Western leaders like Macron that it was their military intervention which brought an end to Daesh is outrageous on two points. Firstly, the very idea that their military intervention helped in any way is a lie. In fact, the opposite is true. It's the consistent meddling and interference and military intervention that broke the fabric of the societies in the Middle East and across Africa, which created the hotbed of chaos that ISIS thrives on. Secondly, it's those Muslim societies which had to fend for themselves, pull together whatever meager resources they could to finally, alhamdulillah, you know, crumble Daesh and whatever they stood for. It's not just offensive on a personal count. It's an outright lie.
During his Iraq tour, Macron visited areas left devastated by terrorism. But instead of gratitude, Macron stole the credit for the group's defeat, adding salt into the wounds of an already irritated Muslim world. Robert Carter, London.
Well, that's your world news for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Half of Afghanistan lives in poverty. 14 million Afghans are food insecure, and 2 million Afghan children are severely hungry. The roaring sound of hunger was combined during these past 20 years with the roaring sound of bombers. This is what the occupation looked like from the ground. We now present you an article written by Vijay Prashad. an Indian historian, editor and journalist. The piece is titled, Afghanistan's Long Struggle for Funding Continues. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Days after the Taliban drove into Kabul on 15th of August, its representatives started making inquiries about the location of assets of the central bank, the Afghanistan Bank, which are known to total about $9 billion. Meanwhile, the central bank in neighboring Uzbekistan, which has an almost equivalent population of about 34 million, compared with Afghanistan's more than 39 million, has international reserves worth $35 billion. Afghanistan is a poor country by comparison, and its resources have been devastated by war and occupation. The Afghanistan Bank, or DAB, officials told the Taliban that the $9 billion was in the Federal Reserve in New York, which means that Afghanistan's wealth is sitting in a bank in the United States. But before the Taliban could even try to access the money, the U.S. Treasury Department froze the DAB, the Afghanistan bank assets, and prevented its transfer into Taliban control. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, had recently allocated $650 billion special drawing rights for disbursement around the world. When asked if Afghanistan would be able to access its share of the SDRs, an IMF official said in an email, as is always the case, the International Monetary Fund is guided by the views of the international community. The official said there is currently a lack of clarity within the international community regarding recognition of a government in Afghanistan, as a consequence of which the country cannot access SDRs or other International Monetary Fund resources. Financial bridges into Afghanistan to tide the country over during the 20 years of war and devastation have slowly collapsed. The International Monetary Fund decided to withhold transfer of $370 million before the Taliban entered Kabul, and now commercial banks and Western Union have suspended money transfers into Afghanistan. Afghanistan's currency, the Afghani, is in a state of free fall. Over the past decade, Afghanistan's formal economy struggled to stay afloat. Since the US-NATO invasion of October of 2001, Afghanistan's government has relied on financial aid flows to support its economy. According to the World Bank, thanks to these funds and strong agricultural growth, the economy experienced an average annual growth rate of about 9.4% between 2003 and 2012. These figures do not include two important facts. Firstly, that large parts of Afghanistan were not in government control, including border posts where taxes are levied. And secondly, illicit drugs such as opium, heroin, and methamphetamine trade is not counted in these figures. According to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, in 2019, the total income from the opium trade in Afghanistan was between $1.2 billion and $2.1 billion. In February 2021, United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime report stated, the gross income from opiates exceeded the value of the country's officially recorded licit exports in 2019. During the past decade, the flow of aid into Afghanistan has collapsed from around 100% of gross domestic product in 2009 to 42.9% of gross domestic product in 2020. The official economic growth rate between 2015 and 2020 fell to 2.5%. The prospects for an increase in aid seemed dire last year. At the 2020 Afghanistan conference held in Geneva, Switzerland in November, the donors decided to provide annual disbursements rather than aid in four-year packages. This meant that the Afghan government would not be able to plan its operations sufficiently. Before the Taliban took over Kabul, Afghanistan had begun to recede from the memory of those countries that had invaded it back in 2001-2002. During the past 20 years, the U.S. government has spent as much as $2.26 trillion on its war and occupation of Afghanistan. European countries spent nothing close to what the United States spent. Germany had spent $19.3 billion by the end of 2018, of which $14.1 billion was to pay for the deployment of its armed forces. In 2016, the Education Minister, Asadullah Hanif Balkhi, said that only 6 million Afghan children attended the country's 17,000 schools, and not 11 million as reported earlier. 41% of Afghanistan's schools do not have buildings. As a result of the failure to provide schools, Afghanistan's Ministry of Education reports that the total literacy rate in the country was 43% in 2020, with 55% being the literacy rate for men and 29.8% being the literacy rate for Afghan women. Donors, aid agencies, and central government officials produced a culture of inflating expectations to encourage optimism and the transfer of more funds, but little of it was true. Meanwhile, it is shocking to note that there was barely any construction of infrastructure to advance basic needs during the past 20 years. The national power company, the Afghanistan Breshna Sherkat, or DABS, reports that only 35% of the population has access to electricity, and that 70% of the electricity power is imported at inflated rates. Half of Afghanistan lives in poverty, 14 million Afghans are food insecure, and 2 million Afghan children are severely hungry. The roaring sound of hunger was combined during these past 20 years with the roaring sound of bombers. This is what the occupation looked like from the ground. In a 2013 New York Times article, a U.S. official admitted the biggest source of corruption in Afghanistan was the United States. Dollars flowed into the country in trunks to be doled out to politicians to buy their loyalty. Contracts to build a new Afghanistan were given freely to U.S. businessmen, many of whom charged fees that were higher than their expenditure inside Afghanistan. Afghanistan's president, Ashraf Ghani, who fled into exile hours before the Taliban took control of Kabul, took office making a lot of noise about ending corruption. When he fled the country, the press secretary of the Russian embassy in Kabul, Nikita Ishchenko, told the RIA Novosti news agency that Ashraf Ghani's people drove four cars filled with money to the airfield. According to a Reuters report, they tried to stuff another part of the money into a helicopter, but not all of it fit. And some of the money was left lying on the tarmac at the airport. Corruption at the top spilled down to everyday life. Afghans reported paying bribes worth $2.25 billion in 2020, 37% higher than in 2018. Part of the reason for the Taliban's rapid advance across Afghanistan over the course of the past decade lies in the failure of the US-NATO-backed governments to improve the situation for ordinary Afghans. Surveys regularly found Afghans saying that they believe corruption levels were lower in Taliban areas. Similarly, Afghans reported that the Taliban would run schools more effectively and efficiently. Within Afghanistan, the Taliban portrayed themselves as more efficient and less corrupt administrators. None of this should allow anyone to assume that the Taliban have become moderate. Their agenda regarding women is identical to what it was at its founding in 1994. In 1996, the Taliban drove into Kabul with the same argument. They would end the civil war in Afghanistan among the Mujahideen, and they would end corruption and inefficiency in the country. The West had 20 years to advance the cause of social development in Afghanistan. Its failure opened the door for the return of the Taliban. The United States has begun to cut off Afghanistan from its own money in U.S. banks and from financial networks. It will use these means to isolate the Taliban. Perhaps this is a way to force the Taliban into a national government with former members of the Karzai Ghani governments. Otherwise, these tactics are plainly vindictive and will only backfire against the West.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Today's question is a continuation of the topic we had last time, which was a very involved and deep discussion, so we'll refrain from summarizing it. But we didn't get to answer why the companions of the Imam, peace be upon him, or the Imam, why didn't he dig a well when they were prevented access to the water by the enemies? Dear Sheikh, please enlighten us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned, for 7 days, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his camp, they were able to have access to Euphrates, of course, with some problems. But then the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, commanded a person to protect the Euphrates with 500 people and prevent Imam Hussein alayhi salam from reaching water and having access to the Euphrates. So why the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam did not dig a well so that they could have access to water? First of all, we mentioned that we should not think that, in a desert like Karbala, you only dig 4 or 5 meters and then you will have access to water. This is not the case. And now we go to the history. The history is telling us that, alhamdulillah, the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam were aware of this opportunity to dig a well, and it happened practically speaking. According to some narrations, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he dug a well some meters away from the tents, so they could not do it inside the tents.
Right.
They did it some feet away from the tent. It's been mentioned, for example, by Ibn Shahr Ashub in Manaqib al-Abi Talib, volume 4, page 50, and Ibn A'tam al-Kufi in Al-Futuh, page 893. So I think with that we have answered the question.
They did dig a well. But the water was enough? It ran out?
Now the problem is that, the point is that Ibn Atham al-Kufi, who has mentioned that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions, they did dig a well around the tent, he mentions a letter which was sent by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, the commander of Yazid in the city of Kufa and the ruler of Kufa, to Umar ibn Sa'd. Let me read you the content of the letter, which is very important. Addressing Umar ibn Sa'd, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad says that I've been informed that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions, they have access to water through the wells. So as soon as you, receive this letter from me, you need to prevent Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam and his companions from digging well and having access to water through the wells. So this point is telling us that, first of all, they did dig well around the tents, and second of all, practically speaking, they were prevented also from having access to the water through the wells. So imagine there are only 72 people, and the army of the enemy, about maybe 30,000 people. So they are not able to, fight with these 30,000 people, only to have access to the wells.
Right.
So as was mentioned by this commander, Umar ibn Sa'd, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions, they were also prevented from having access to the wells.
So this well that the Imam, peace be upon him, he dug, it ran out of water, or was it not close to the tents at all? It was a bit further away.
It was a bit far from the tents, but maybe what is understood from this letter is that those soldiers of Umar ibn Sa'd, they may have been able to somehow, fill the well again with...
Exactly, they have the manpower, yeah, and they also have archers.
Yeah, that's the point.
Right.
So, as commanded by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, we came to this conclusion that for any reason, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions were prevented from having access to water through the wells too. So that is why we see that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, maybe they lose this option to have access to water through the wells. And then that is why we see that from time to time Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam sends some people like Abu Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam to go to Euphrates and bring water. And as I mentioned in the previous program, in some cases, they were able to bring some water skins, like in one historical report, we are told about bringing 20 water skins by 40 people. Imam Hussein alayhi salam sends 40 people.
40 people to only bring 20 water skins.
Yeah. Commanded by Abu Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam, there was a serious fight, but anyway, they were able to bring 20 water skins. It's been mentioned by, in Tariq Tabari, volume 7, page 3007, and also Maqatir al-Talibiyin, page 119, and many other sources.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Insha'Allah, you'll find your way. So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, was not neglecting the fact that they need water.
Of course not.
And one of the options was digging a well. So according to some narrations, they did it, but then they were prevented from that. And second of all, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was forced to send some of his companions to bring water, and they did. But are they able to have access to water, I mean, free and without any fight, and to bring water as many as or as much as they wanted and they, I mean, needed? No. And they needed to fight, and they were only able to bring a few water skins, which was not enough for all those 200 people, including women and children. And as you rightly mentioned, even the horses, they needed water. And we know that it was in one of these cases that, according to some narrations, Abu al-Fadl Abbas, when he went to the river to bring some water for the people, because according to some narrations, Imam Hussein alayhi salam asked Abbas to bring water for the thirsty kids and women, and it was through this, mission of Abu al-Fadl Abbas alayhi salam, that when he was coming back, he was surrounded by the armies of Umar ibn Sa'd, and he was martyred. According to some narrations, we mentioned that Abu al-Fadl Abbas reached the Euphrates. He wanted to drink. Narrators, they say that he remembered the thirst of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, so he did not drink water. He filled the water skins with water, but on his way back, he was surrounded by the enemies, and he was martyred. So the point is that for 3 days, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions needed to fight for having water. And on the 10th day of Muharram, the day of Ashura, when fighting took place between the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, it was more difficult to have access to water, because you are fighting the enemy, and at the same time, you need to go to the Euphrates and fight again to bring water. So you cannot. You need to fight in two directions. So it's very difficult.
Right.
And we know that the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam are getting martyred one after the other. So and finally, even Abu al-Fadl Abbas alayhi salam is martyred. So we cannot negate the fact that, at least for the day of Ashura, for many hours, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, his companions, and his family members, including women and the kids, they did not have access to water. And as I mentioned, on the land of Karbala, on that time in the year, as long as you stay, you walk, even without fighting, for half an hour, you get thirsty.
Right.
And then imagine that you are fighting with all those heavy,
equipment, and shields, and you're running around, and you're carrying a sword, and you swing it. And
exactly.
Hitting.
So you would get thirsty very soon, and it comes to the kids, we know that they get thirsty, and they are not able to tolerate the situation. So the thirst of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his family members and his companions, especially on the day of Ashura, is a fact, and no one can deny that. Regarding digging the well, we said that according to some narrations,
they tried.
It was done, but they were prevented. And the last point is that we should not think that every kind of water is drinkable.
That's a good point.
Yeah. In some cases, we may think of digging a well, but then the water is not in a quality that people can drink it.
Right.
Because there is another question that reads that according to some narrations, some of the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they made a ghusl, a major ablution, before the day of Ashura, of course. So the question is that, how do you claim that they didn't have access to water? They are doing ghusl.
Right.
So there are different answers. One of the answers is that it was not done during the day of Ashura. For sure, it was done before that. And as I mentioned, before the day of Ashura, from time to time, they had access to water through fighting. And second of all, the other answer is that it's very likely that they were doing ghusl with a water which was not drinkable.
Salt water, for example.
A salt water. So we shouldn't think that ghusl is a sign that for the whole 10 days they had access to drinkable water.
Right.
No, it was not done on the day of Ashura, which is the main point, the main scene in which the camp does not have access to water. And the second point is that it may have been done with a water which was not drinkable. Maybe they dig a well, but then the water is not drinkable, so they make the ghusl or the major ablution.
So in summary, the Imam and his family and children and companions, they were all thirsty for at the very least 3 days.
Exactly.
With no drinkable water. And on that sad and very
sorrowful. Indeed, 3 days, from time to time you have access water, but that water is not enough for
people. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your time, and I thank the dear listeners for tuning in. This has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
After the killing of George Floyd and subsequent mass protests, the USHRN and the ACLU organized an international coalition that urged the HRC to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate systematic racism and police violence against people of African descent in the United States of America. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Marjorie Kahn Ryder. This article is published under the heading UN Report Calls for Reparations for Victims of Systematic Racist Police Violence in the US. Stay tuned for more. On June 28, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, released a stunning 23-page report accompanied by a 95-page conference room paper for the UN Human Rights Council, HRC, documenting systematic racism and human rights violations by police forces against Africans and people of African descent throughout the world. The report considered more than 340 interviews and more than 100 submissions from civil society organizations. Bachelet grounded her analysis in the long overdue need to confront the legacies of enslavement, the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans and colonialism, and to seek reparatory justice. She took aim at misconceptions that the abolition of slavery, the end of the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans and colonialism, and subsequent reforms have eliminated the racially discriminatory structures built by those practices and created equal societies. Thank you. report finds the dehumanization of people of African descent, a practice rooted in false social constructions of race created to justify enslavement, pervasive racial stereotypes, and widely accepted harmful practices and traditions, has sustained and cultivated a tolerance for racial discrimination, inequality, and violence, which continues to have a disproportionate impact on the enjoyment of their human rights. Systematic racism needs a systematic response, Bachelet wrote. States should adopt a systematic approach to combating racial discrimination through the adoption and monitoring of whole-of-government and whole-of-society responses. They should be designed to dismantle systematic racism. Hailing the report as a victory, the U.S. Human Rights Network, USHRN, issued a statement saying it reflects the efforts of civil society to educate UN officials about human rights violations and the people's solutions, even convening a People's Commission of Inquiry to take on what the UN declined to do last year. After the killing of George Floyd and subsequent mass protests, the USHRN and the ACLU organized an international coalition that urged the HRC to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate systematic racism and police violence against people of African descent in the United States of America. Instead, on June 19, 2020, after intensive lobbying by Trump administration, the HRC adopted Resolution 43-1, directing the High Commissioner to prepare a report on police violence and other human rights violations against Africans and people of African descent around the world, not limited to the United States. Thus, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, National Conference of Black Lawyers, and National Lawyers Guild established their own International Commission Inquiry on Systematic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent in the United States. The Commission issued its report on April 15, 2021. The worldwide mobilization of people calling for racial justice has forced a long-delayed reckoning with racism and shifted debates towards a focus on the systematic nature of racism and the institutions that perpetrate it, Bachelet wrote. Bachelet's report indicts the culture of systematic racism, denial and impunity of law enforcement officials for violating the human rights of people of African descent. She lays blame for the racialization of poverty, a defeat of insufficient, meaningful participation of people of African descent, and decision-making and impediments to their right to vote. Bachelet charges that the dehumanization of people of African descent is rooted in false social constructions of race historically created to justify enslavement, pervasive racial stereotypes, and false narratives that associate people of African descent with criminal activities. Discriminatory identity checks and stops and searches are attributable to racial profiling, according to Bachelet. And she condemns disproportionate stops, arrests, and imprisonment for drug-related offenses. Bachelet's analysis of 190 cases globally, most from the United States, revealed that at least 85% of police-related deaths could be attributed to policing of minor offenses, traffic stops, and stops and searches, such as the case of George Floyd, intervention of police as first responders to mental health crises, and special police operations like the case of Breonna Taylor. Many of the victims did not pose an imminent threat of death or serious injury to justify lethal force under international legal standards. Harmful stereotypes shape encounters between people of African descent and law enforcement, and gang-related police operations in communities of African descent are frequently influenced by racial bias and stereotypes that associate those communities by criminality, Bashala found, citing the commission report. Challenges to holding police officers accountable for violating human rights of people of African descent, detailed by Bashale, include the absence of independent accountability mechanisms and deficient investigations, prosecutorial direction and reluctance to file charges against police, qualified immunity and police unions, citing the Commission's report discussion of these issues. As did the Commission report, Bashale cited a 2021 University of Chicago study which found that use of force legislation and directives in the largest cities of the 29 wealthiest countries often did not comply with international human rights law. No state has comprehensively accounted for the past or for the current impact of systematic racism, Bashale notes, adding structures and systems that were designed and shaped by enslavement, colonialism, and successive racially discriminatory policies and systems must be transformed. Jamil Dakwar, director of the ACLU's Human Rights Program, also responded to Bashale's report, stating, "This historic report provides a blueprint for the United States and other countries to begin reckoning with the long history of systematic racism that permeates through policing and other state violence and structural discrimination against black people. We welcome this report and urge the Biden administration and Congress to heed the recommendations and take bold action to eliminate systematic racism in the United States, starting with policing institutions." Bashale writes, "Reparatory justice requires a multi-pronged approach that is grounded in international rights law. Reparations are one element of accountability and redress. For every violation, there should be repair of the harms caused through adequate, effective, and prompt reparation." She notes that reparations are not limited to monetary compensation, but also include formal apologies, memorializations, institutional and educational reforms, and acknowledgement of the legal responsibility of the state for violations linked to truth, justice, guarantees of non-recurrence.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.